Good morning. It's so good to see you this morning. Appreciate the effort that you made to be here. Beth and I were a little bit later than we wanted to be. Technically, I guess you could say I was trying to go to church at two places at once. I was watching the broadcast from Redland Road because our 10 o'clock worship service I was able to watch it, and one of our deacons, Brother Tom Young, preached for in my place this morning. He did an excellent job, and one of our young men responded to the invitation, and this young man has gotten himself into a situation where he has really messed up his life. A lot of it he did kind of in secret, and it all began to come to light, and he's got a new wife and a brand new baby, and is because of all that has gone on in the last couple of years before his marriage and even after his marriage, he's also looking at the prospects of a brand new divorce. And it would be an understatement to say that he, at least from all appearances, is doing everything he can possibly think of to avoid that from happening. And he responded to the invitation this morning. And one of our other elders was asked to lead the prayer, asking for forgiveness for his sake. And the elder was so emotional and choked up that he just stood there at the microphone. In fact, I thought I'd lost the audio from the transmission. It just took him a little bit to compose himself, and that was the... You can see now why I was so riveted on that, watching that that broadcast. And hopefully things will continue to go in the right direction for that young man and for his family. And we pray that his family will remain intact. It's been announced that we're going to talk about an incremental journey this morning. Incremental literally means proceeding or changing by small steps or degrees. As we would say back home, a little bit at a time. And you can imagine a journey, a movement from one place to the other, that if it were described as an incremental journey, a journey of tiny steps, a journey of moving sometimes so slowly and so deliberately that it's almost, you've heard that old saying, you know, draw a line in the sand so we can tell if you're moving or not. That's kind of the way the incremental journey that I want to tell you about should kind of fit into our minds. We're going to be studying from Genesis chapter 13. If you have your Bibles, open up to there. And we're going to be reading several verses as we study this incremental journey. And incremental or incrementalism is the method that a lot of things operate on. A lot of bad things happen in tiny increments, a little bit at a time, and sometimes as they go through that process, we almost sort of wake up and realize what's been happening for a long time and we've done nothing about it, and now we've got a terrible situation that has to be dealt with. Some illnesses are that way. Cancer, in particular, seems to work that way in many cases where it grows very small and a little bit bigger. In fact, so small that it's not noticed at first. And then later when it finally is discovered or found, then it's a major ordeal. Termites in your house. I don't know how in the world termites could survive out here because they have to have moisture in order to live. But back home, that's a real problem. We have a major problem with termites, and those things can live in the structure of your home for years without showing any kind of external evidence until the right kind of inspection is made or until the roof starts to fall in one corner of the house or something like that. And you realize this has been going on for a long time. These guys, these little termites, these little wood-consuming insects have been working at it incrementally. Rust on your automobile. Again, I doubt you have a major problem with it here, but back home, whenever we look at a used automobile to purchase, we always want to ask the question, where'd this car come from? Because if it came from Wisconsin or somewhere like that, we want to crawl up under the underside and look and see how bad the rust from the salt on the roads in the wintertime when the roads freeze and they put the salt down and all of that slush gets on the metal of the underside of the car, and I've seen cars that look perfectly fine from the outside, and when you got up on the underside and looked, there's just nothing there. I mean, everything except the backside of the paint job is gone in some places. Happens a little bit at a time. I want to talk to you this morning about Lot, Abraham's nephew. And Lot made an incremental journey. We're going to call this an incremental journey into worldliness. It's important that we understand what we're talking about when we say worldliness, because there are some ideas about worldliness that are a little bit, well, let's just say that they're a little bit too restrictive. There are some folks who believe that worldliness only has to do with the depths of things like drunkenness and maybe gambling, spending all of your time at a casino, or even things like prostitution and some of those worst of the worst moral sins. And some people believe that's all that worldliness is. It's just those really, really bad things. But I got to tell you that worldliness is not limited to the vice and the corruption that is characteristic of some of the most wicked places and wicked people in the world. Worldliness is defined as concern with material values rather than spiritual existence. Concerned about worldly or material values more so than spiritual values. Now, I invite you to think that through a little bit, because that wraps its tentacles, no offense to any octopus in the audience, but that wraps its tentacles around a whole lot of ordinary, otherwise we would say good people. But people who have a hard time giving spiritual matters the right priority in their lives. The reason they can't give the right priority to the spiritual things is because they're placing material things on a higher level than the spiritual things. Well, now let's just get right down to the nitty-gritty about it. Let's talk in some really, really plain terms. And if a person is struggling, I've been beating on these flowers all weekend and they've survived. They are really, really hardy. They must have been grown in Alabama. That's all I can think of. Let's just say a person really has trouble with worship attendance because there's always something going on that they think they want to do that is really really important to them, and so worship attendance then drops to a lower level, and that other thing rises to take the top priority. Now, that's just a real quick and simple illustration. And don't go home and say, boy, that preacher, he got up there and threw rocks at me because I was not at the assembly last night. That's not my point. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just using an easy illustration. Anytime we let any aspect of serving God drop to a lower level of importance, that's not to say that there aren't some things that would hinder you legitimately from doing the right thing in a certain situation. In addition to being a gospel preacher, I'm a construction inspector for the Montgomery Water Works in Montgomery, Alabama, and part of my responsibility is to inspect the work that contractors do as they lay water and sewer lines in our system, the Montgomery Water Works system. And there have been occasions when I was on call and had to go to a specific emergency job and had to call in someone to stand in for me at worship services. And I don't think that I had committed some kind of sin by doing that, but if every time you turned around, I was finding a way to be somewhere else instead of being in the assembly with the Lord's people, you could say then that I was really having a problem with some worldly issues. So don't think that worldliness is only those things that we've characterized as being the worst of the worst sins. Worldliness is when we put more emphasis on material than on spiritual. Consistently, as a habit, as a part of our lives. And as we're going to see from the case of Lot here in just a minute, it's something that begins really small. And it works on us a little bit at a time, and it gets worse and worse and worse. And of course, the end result is we've fallen completely away from the Lord. And we certainly don't want that to happen in any situation, in any case. And thus, the importance of recognizing the incremental nature of a journey into worldliness. There is a really good Bible definition of worldliness recorded in 1 John chapter 2. 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17, where John says, do not love the world, neither the things are the things that are in the world, for if anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, and then he categorizes in the three categories all that is in the world: the desire of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, and the pride of life. As we say often, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the glory, pride, vainglory of life. He says, this is not from the Father, but is from the world, and the world is passing away along with its desires. But whoever does the will of God abides forever. So you might say, there's our good working Bible definition of worldliness. Worldliness is a condition that we suffer from when we put more emphasis on things of the world and less emphasis in our lives on things of God. When we replace spiritual pursuits with earthly pursuits, when we minimize purity and holiness in our personal private lives. That's worldliness. Remember, purity and holiness originate from the heart, not just on the surface, not just on the outside. And we know from a whole host of Bible characters that the Word of God tells us about, and perhaps even from our own personal experience, that following after worldliness is an incremental journey. So let's take a look at Lot's journey, and let's look there in Genesis chapter 13, and first of all, notice what verse 2 says. Now, Abram, now I got to tell you up front, I kind of wish that God hadn't changed Abraham's name. I wish he'd have just been Abraham from the beginning, because whenever I read it, and a lot of times when I say it, even though it's an early stage in his life when his name was Abram, I still call him Abraham. So if I call him Abraham in this part of his life, you understand I'm just having a hard time. But verse 2 says, now Abram was very rich in livestock and silver and in gold. Now, drop down to verse 5 and notice what verses 5 through 7 says. And Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents, so that the land could not support both of them dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together, and there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. We've got a situation where two guys, an uncle and a nephew, are together. They've just come up out of Egypt and they've gone into what is known or will be known for sure as the land of Canaan. It's a very rich and fertile land, and they've got a situation where they've got so many cattle that the two of them together are overburdening the land, and as is often the case, their herdsmen, the men who are responsible for taking care of their herds and flocks, are in a competitive situation where they're trying to get the best grazing for their animals, and Lot's guys say, we're here first, and Abram's guys say, well, you've been there for 6 weeks, it's time for you to move on and let us graze this land. You know, and so just there's no end to all of the potential problems. And so Abram, very wise man, says, look, we've got a situation here where we need to do something. And look at verse 8. Then Abram said to Lot, let no strife be between you and me and between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we're kinsmen. Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, then I'll go to the right. Or if you take the right hand, I'll go to the left. And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar. And this was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself all of the Jordan Valley, and Lot journeyed east. Thus they separated from each other, and Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled among the cities of the valley and moved his tent as far as Sodom. And we're going to stop with verse 13, which says, now the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. Now, let me tell you something. There is not a superfluous word in all of the Bible. Don't worry, I had to look it up too. Superfluous means more than is needed. There's not an extra word in the Bible. It's not there for a reason. And I believe verse 13 is there to focus our attention in on the situation that Lot is getting himself closer and closer to. Lot pitched his tent toward Sodom, and the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. Now I want to give you two or three points. And I've got to confess, I've got PowerPoint, but the PowerPoint is on my flash drive in the hotel room, which was left in my haste to get here on time. since I had delayed so long in watching the broadcast from Redland Road, and I almost turned around and went back to get it, but I would have been about 15 minutes late getting here. Let me just tell you what the PowerPoint looks like. If you've got an imagination like I have, this will help. I've got in that PowerPoint, in the 3 points that we're going to discuss, 3 road signs like you see out on the highway. And every one of those road signs have something on them that represents one of the signs of the things that Lot was getting closer and closer to. And on that first sign, we see a strategy of selfishness. A strategy of selfishness. Now remember, as we study this lesson about Lot, we're looking primarily for some points and some lessons that are applicable to us as God's people today. I mean, if we can learn from Lot's mistakes, that's a good thing. And remember, the Bible itself tells us that those things that were written aforetime are written for our learning. And the things that these people went through are there as our examples that we can learn from. And so I want to point out the first thing that was wrong in Lot's mind was he was operating from the standpoint of a strategy of selfishness. Now, why do I say right here at the very beginning, why do you brand Lot as a selfish man? Well, let's look back at the text again. And here's something that helps to highlight the selfishness of Lot. You know what it is? This is a very important point. It's the graciousness of Abram that makes us recognize the selfishness of Lot. Listen to what Abraham said to him in verse 9. There I went. Did you catch that, Abraham? Abram, listen to what Abram says here in verse 9. He says, "Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left, then I'll go to the right. If you take the right, I'll go to the left." Lot, my nephew, my old buddy, my co-worker, my fellow rancher here, look, you're a young guy. You certainly don't have the seniority here. You certainly don't have the status that I do. But I tell you what, I'm going to let you make the first choice. You take whatever you want out there, and wherever you decide to take your herds, I'll take mine in the opposite direction. Now, is that not very gracious? I think it is. We'd have a lot of difficulty with disagreeing with the fact that Abram was very gracious in his proposal to Lot. And because Abram was so gracious, we want Lot to say, "Come on, Unc. You're a lot older than I am. You've probably even got more cattle than I have, and so you really need to make the first choice. You take whichever one you want, and I'll..." Is that what Lot did? No. But now, hold on. I'm not piling up a pile of rocks getting ready to throw at Lot just yet. He does a pretty good job of that himself as we get into this story. But I think that it's a valid point to say that Abram's graciousness causes us to recognize Lot's selfishness. And so Lot chose... I like the way verse 11 reads, and I think the tone of this wording lends itself to our point. So Lot chose for himself all the Jordan Valley. And Lot journeyed east. Thus they separated from each other. When Lot looked out at the beautiful land of the valley of the Jordan, he liked it. He wanted it. He didn't deserve it. He should have deferred to Abraham's first choice, but he didn't. He took it for himself. And I believe in that we see an illustration of the principle of selfishness. And so let's understand this. one of the most powerful medicines in the prevention of worldliness in our lives is the practice of unselfishness. Unselfishness. Now, if you're like me right now, your mind is a whirl just thinking back to all of the decisions that you've made and all of the choices that you've made. And it may very well be that everything was above board, everything was legitimate, just exactly as it is here in the case of Lot and Abram. And maybe you're recognizing, though, that, well, you know, if I hadn't chosen that on that occasion, then I wouldn't have what I have today. Okay, that's a valid point. And that's not necessarily bad. Unless, in making those choices motivated by a self-concern and a selfish attitude, we let that go further and further and further, and eventually it becomes a pattern of our lives. That's why I say that one of the most powerful medicines in the prevention of worldliness is the practice of unselfishness. Unselfishness, like Paul refers to in Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, where he says, "Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interest, but also for the interest of others." And you know, we're at a point here where we could say, enough said. I don't see how the point could be made any more clearly than the way Paul makes it right there in that passage. But you know, there's also Romans chapter 12, beginning in verse 9, where Paul writes to the Roman Christians and he says, "Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil, cleave to that which is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Give preference to one another in honor, not lagging behind in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, persevering in tribulation, devoted to prayer, contributing to the needs of the saints, practicing hospitality." All of those are little, small things that we need to be plugging into our lives in the interest of offsetting the human tendency of selfish concern. We are well familiar with what it says there in verse 12 of Lot's choice, where it says, "Lot pitched his tent as far as Sodom." But let's go a little further. Let's follow Lot down this road, and let's observe another sign that we come to, and this sign tells us that Lot has allowed himself to get right in the middle of some really, and here's what's on the sign, sordid surroundings. Sordid, S-O-R-D-I-D, sordid surroundings. Now, you probably remember some more of the story of Lot and Abram and their existence there in that part of the world, because in chapter 14 we learn about Abram's going to the rescue of Lot. Those invading kings who came in and marched in and took the people and the goods from Sodom and Gomorrah. And our first thought is, well, you know, the Bible says Lot pitched his tent toward Sodom. Maybe by this time he's recognized what's going on there and he's kind of backed off a little bit and he's moved a little further out, at least into the suburbs and gotten away from all of that. No. Look at verse 12 in Genesis 14. They also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom. Lot, come on, man. You started out with your tent toward Sodom, but now you're living in Sodom. Of course, it was Abram to the rescue again. You remember the story, how that Abram raised his own personal army of 318 trained men, his personal security force, and he went in pursuit of those four marauding kings, and he not only defeated them, but he got Lot back, he got Lot's possessions back, he got all the people of Sodom and Gomorrah back and all of their possessions back. And along the way, you remember he had an encounter with that mysterious character in the Old Testament and in the book of Hebrews, Melchizedek. And so we might say, I might say, Bruce, what time is this period over? Okay, 10:15. So we might say, in view of Lot, okay, surely this old boy has learned his lesson now. He started out toward Sodom. He was living in Sodom. He's been carried away with all of the people of Sodom. He's been rescued by Uncle Abram. And so surely he's going to say to his family, look, folks, we got to get out of this town. We can't move back into Sodom. We can't go back home. We've got to establish ourselves outside the city. Right? Wrong. Right back in the middle of the city. It just goes to show that some lessons are not easily learned. And if you think licking worldliness and its temptations is easy, you are sadly mistaken. Because the devil doesn't give up. He keeps on working. You know, this might be a good time to bring up something that a lot of people bring up about Lot. In fact, some folks might even say, well, you know, brother, you're being a little hard on Lot because the Bible describes him in the New Testament as a righteous man. Is that true? Absolutely. It's over there in 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2 calls him more than once righteous Lot. 2 Peter chapter 2 from verses 4 through 10. But I want you to understand the point that's being made here in 2 Peter. And Lot is an illustration among many in this point that Peter is making about God's concern for those who are His people. And God's fact of justice and the fact that He will always recompense. It says, if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell, committed them into chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until judgment, if He did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a herald of righteousness, with seven others when He brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, if by turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes, He condemned them to extinction, making them an example of what is going to happen to the ungodly, and if He rescued righteous Lot, greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked, for as that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment. What's the point made about Lot? God rescued him. And that's exactly what God did. Just as He was right on the threshold of sending down the fire and brimstone to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, God sent those angels to literally take Lot by the hand and lead him. Now, that's being nice. I think the better term would be to drag him and his family out of Sodom. Peter isn't justifying the decision that Lot made to live in Sodom. He's actually calling attention to the fact that Lot allowed himself to stay in a situation where things were going on all around him that he knew better, and his soul was vexed by it on a continual basis. The unsaid part of 2 Peter chapter 2 is, and Lot stayed there. And the only way he got away was when God sent an angel to take him by the hand and drag him out. And even in so doing, he lost his wife in the process. And even worse things than that happened shortly thereafter with his daughters. So, yes, comparatively speaking, Lot was a righteous man living in the middle of a whole bunch of wicked people. And that's our third point. That's our third road sign that you see in your mind, hopefully. And it's the fact that Lot ultimately found himself living by a set of unseemly standards. Unseemly standards. Let's follow his journey. First of all, he starts out with a step into selfishness. And then in the second place, we see him get right in the middle of some sordid surroundings as he moves into the city and surrounded by this wickedness. And then the third step in the process, he's beginning to live by some unseemly standards. The standard of behavior that he is living by. Why do I say that? Look where we find Lot in Genesis chapter 19, verse 1, when those angels come to deliver the message of escape from the impending destruction of Sodom. Lot was sitting in the gate of the city. Now, that may not mean too much to us today because, well, our cities don't even have gates. You know, every now and then a visiting dignitary will come through and your mayor will present him with what? A key to the city. That's just a token. That's just a representative thing. That's just an illustration of their appreciation for that dignitary and so forth. Lot had been given a key to the city. In biblical terminology, especially according to the times and the culture, anybody that sat in the gate of the city was regarded as one of the wise and officially important people in that city. The gate of the city was kind of like the courthouse. That's where important meetings were held. That's where important hearings were conducted. If you were looking for a high official, you would go to the gate of the city. And here in chapter 19, verse 1, that's where we find Lot. So what has he done? Has he acclimated himself to the standards by which he is surrounded? Has he adopted the standards of those around him? I suggest that he has to some degree. Otherwise, he would not have been where he was. He was not, would not have been sitting in the gate of the city. Now, as those angels approach Lot, you remember what happened when the men of Sodom in some unspeakable ways expressed their desire for some very immoral interaction with those visitors, and Lot takes up their case in chapter 19, verse 7. And he talks to the men who have surrounded his house, the men of Sodom, and he says, I beg you, brothers, do not act so wickedly. I want to suggest to you there were a lot of things that he could have said that would have been more aligned with the attitude of a servant of God. But rather, he approaches the men of Sodom in their wickedness and refers to them as brothers. I almost hate to go to the next point in verse 8 because I don't understand it. I can't understand what would possess a man, any man, to do what Lot offers to do next. Let's just cut to the chase. These men of Sodom are professionals in the art, if it's an art, of homosexuality. And they have expressed a desire that these two visitors to Lot's house come out so that they can have relations with them. And Lot says in verse 8, behold, I have two daughters who have not known any man. Let me bring them out to you and do to them as you please. I just can't. I can't understand it. In the interest of time, which now has only 2 minutes left for me, let's think ahead in this story to what Lot did when the angels said, you got to get out of here. We are about to destroy this place. We got to go. Take up your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city. And verse 16 says, but he lingered. But he lingered. Folks, let me be very honest with you. That is the typical response of the person who has made this journey little by little into worldliness to the extent that the worldliness has gained control of their lives. At every invitation to change, at every insistence that you get out of this, you hesitate, you linger. You put it off. We're out of time, but we could look ahead to the latter part of this particular chapter, and we could see in the behavior of Lot's daughters what had surely been the result of the influence that living in the city of Sodom had had on them. You know the story. And so Lot has allowed himself incrementally, step by step, to be taken into the realm of worldliness. But not just Lot. He's totally without the respect of his son-in-laws, whether they are literally married to his daughters or whether they're just betrothed. It's not clear in the scriptures. But they laughed at him when he said, we've got to get out of here. He lost his wife in the process because she turned around and deliberately disobeyed the instruction, do not look back. And she turned into a pillar of salt. He's lost the morality of his two daughters after they've reached the safety of a cave in the mountains. when he commits the act of adultery and fornication with his own two daughters. How much more do we need to make us realize how dangerous worldliness in our lives can be, and how it begins and proceeds often in the smallest increments or steps? Okay, I've gone 3 minutes over. We'll take that off of the sermon.